This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll explore how a group of taxpayers are working to stop the U.S. government from continuing its costly and unlawful support for Israel's war in Gaza.
Taxpayers Against Genocide has just issued a report to the UN Human Rights Council's Universal Periodic Review and is about to file an official complaint.
Then we'll be joined by investigative reporter Peter Byrne to discuss his ongoing exposé of the militarization of artificial intelligence.
Peter's work is frequently featured by Project Censored and other independent outlets. He has consistently written about the hidden mechanisms behind surveillance, privatization, and unchecked corporate power. Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. The Israeli genocide in Gaza continues without any end in sight, resulting in the slaughter of over 50,000 Palestinians, with over 113,000 wounded. Meanwhile, the United States is escalating its support for Israel. Donald Trump is sending obscene amounts of military aid to Israel to help fuel the extermination of the Palestinian people, while threatening to take over the Palestinian homeland and turn it into the Riviera of the Middle East. But most Americans disapprove of Trump's handling of the war in Gaza. Support for Israel in the United States is at the lowest it's been in 25 years, and support for the Palestinians is up 6 points since last year. About 60% of Americans fully support a ceasefire in Gaza. So the question is, what can be done to restrain the United States government from its costly, illegal, and inhumane support for Israel's war in Gaza? Taxpayers Against Genocide, TAG, has an answer. TAG is a grassroots mass movement comprised of over 1,000 U.S. taxpayers. Countless federal taxpayers repeatedly called, emailed, petitioned, and peacefully protested their congressional representatives and the U.S. government officials to stop using their tax dollars to fund what had become clear was a genocide in Gaza. After almost 1 year of having their Congress members refused to meet or consider their constituents' pleas, a group of Northern California taxpayers formed Taxpayers Against Genocide in the fall of 2024 and filed a federal class action lawsuit arguing that it is illegal to use tax dollars for genocide. But unfortunately, the case was dismissed on February 10, 2025. Undaunted, TAG is not giving up. On February 19, TAG launched a national call to action. With the support of the National Lawyers Guild, on the day this program will be broadcast, April 7, 2025, TAG will submit a comprehensive report to the United Nations Human Rights Council's Universal Periodic Review. And on April 30, TAG will file an official complaint with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. To describe all of these developments and give us a preview of the report and the official complaint, we're very pleased to have with us today Huwaida Araf, Palestinian-American attorney and human rights activist. She is co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement, supporting Palestinian popular resistance on the ground in the occupied Palestinian territory, and also an organizer with the Freedom Flotilla to break the siege in Gaza. In the U.S., she practices civil rights law and is an active member of the National Lawyers Guild. We also have with us Margaret DiMatteo. She's a movement lawyer and former class member of the TAG lawsuit that we'll be talking about today. She is currently working on the submission to the United Nations Human Rights Council's Universal Periodic Review of the United States based on its complicity in the ongoing genocide in Gaza. To Huwaida and Margaret, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you. It's good to be with you.
Margaret, the last time representatives of TAG were on Law and Disorder, they told us about your federal lawsuit in which you are a plaintiff. Remind our listeners what you alleged in that lawsuit, and then explain the court ruling that dismissed the case.
Sure. So in December of 2024, we filed a class action lawsuit that ultimately expanded in an amendment to include over 1,000 federal taxpayers in Northern California across several districts. We primarily and initially sued our congressional representatives, Jared Huffman and Mike Thompson. We allege that they, by supporting military aid to Israel in their vote in April 2024 to allocate $26.38 billion as part of the Israel Security Supplemental Appropriations Act, were complicit in genocide against Palestinians. And in doing so, they misused taxpayer dollars, which violates the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, U.S. federal laws, and international treaties to include the Genocide Convention. We also allege that there's no way our elected officials did not know what the money and weapons they appropriated to Israel was being used for. Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International had reported just 2 months prior that the Israeli government was, quote, systematically starving the people of Gaza through cutting off aid, water, electricity, by bombing and military occupation, all underwritten by the provisions of U.S. military aid and weapons. And, you know, also our class members had been writing, calling, and emailing them for months, begging for mercy for Palestine. Despite this, the federal court dismissed our case. They said that the decisions regarding foreign aid fall under the purview of the legislative and executive branches, rendering them non-justiciable political questions beyond the court's authority. And that's the same precedent that the court used to dismiss Defense of Children's International, Palestine versus Biden, that the Center for Constitutional Rights filed in November of 2023. And it's also the precedent that was used to dismiss Corey v. Caterpillar in 2007. What's striking and frankly absurd is that the precedent that the courts use to dismiss our case, they're essentially saying that decisions about foreign military aid fall into the category of political questions and that the judiciary can't touch them. But this is not a foreign policy issue, and that's not the way we framed it in our complaint. It's about how our tax dollars, which is money that's taken from our paychecks here in the U.S. at home, are being used. That is a domestic issue, if ever there was one. And, you know, some of our class representatives and class members are Palestinian and have family that's been directly impacted, if not killed, by these appropriations. And the judicial branch, you know, it's supposed to be a check on legislative and executive branch, reviewing whether government policies are constitutional. That is literally its job. So when a policy involves sending billions of dollars in weapons to a country that's credibly accused of committing genocide, it's just, it's hard to understand how that's not a matter for judicial review. And that's what, you know, led us here to this moment where we're trying to avail ourselves of other mechanisms.
Huwaida, could you please talk about some of your legal and political activism with the Movement for Palestinian Liberation, and also describe how you got involved in Taxpayers Against Genocide?
Sure. Well, I started off by trying to be engaged in conflict resolution, even though this is not a conflict. It is a matter of a settler colonialism, apartheid, and genocide. But back when I first became directly involved, I decided to move to the occupied Palestinian territory and try to engage in conflict resolution programs, which I quickly realized were not only insufficient, but actually very harmful, because they normalize this situation of institutionalized racism and don't do any of the work to break down and to dismantle these systems that actually oppress people. So whereas these conflict resolution programs focus on understanding each other and not hating each other, that's not the problem that we have in Israel-Palestine. It's not a religious conflict. It's not, you know, an age-old conflict. It is a situation where Israel has colonized the land and it has been attempting to get rid of the Palestinian people. And for the Palestinian people that it doesn't drive out or kill, it wants to dominate them. And that's how it is instituted a regime of apartheid. Now, I left that work and became involved in founding the International Solidarity Movement, and that was aimed at supporting Palestinian popular resistance by inviting people from all over the world to come to the occupied Palestinian territory and to stand with Palestinians in their resistance, because when Palestinians were marching or protesting alone, they would be injured, arrested, maimed, killed with zero accountability. Palestinians have no one to protect them. And so we thought with international eyes on what Palestinians are doing and what Israel is doing to the Palestinians, we could help elevate and get the truth out about what's happening. So I did that for a number of years, and then I became interested in the legal aspect, like how does law play into the fight for justice for victims of gross human rights abuses, and where is the law when it comes to holding international perpetrators of war crimes accountable? And so I went to law school and focused on these things. And since then, my activism has been wherever I can be, kind of on the ground. What can we do legally? And also, what can we do politically? Because one thing you learn in law school, and when you're especially a movement lawyer, you learn that the law is a tool. The law is not going to save you. It's not going to free us. It oftentimes does not bring justice at all, because there is no enforcement mechanism. And especially when you're talking about international law, not only is there no enforcement mechanism, but the enforcement comes back to the states. And in order to move the states to act in the way they should, you need the political will to do it. And who drives the political will? It is the people. So it's the actions that we engage in on the ground, especially in the United States, which is fueling Israel's apartheid and genocide. It is really up to the people, the American people, to move their government to stop, to change policy. And so I've been involved on that level too. And so how did I come to be involved with the TAG lawsuit? The TAG organizers reached out to the National Lawyers Guild, which I'm very involved with, seeking support for their lawsuit. And so I connected with them. And unfortunately, because I have been following different lawsuits, like Margaret mentioned, Corey v. Caterpillar, where Rachel Corey was a member of the International Solidarity Movement who was crushed to death by the Israeli military driving a Caterpillar bulldozer. And when her parents tried to sue Caterpillar, because they know that they are providing these heavy military equipment to Israel to commit human rights abuses and war crimes, the court essentially said, this is a political question, we're not going to get involved. And similar lawsuits to hold these human rights violators accountable have met the same fate. So I knew that from the start that we're not going to get very far in the U.S. political system. And when the court did dismiss the lawsuit, we decided to go international and to seek, and we really do need the world's help to pressure the United States to stop bankrolling Israel's genocide, to stop participating in this genocide and 80 years long oppression of the Palestinian people. And so we are going to the UN and we are going to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights.
So let's turn to those initiatives. Margaret, we know this pernicious doctrine of political questions is intended to block anyone seeking real justice in the United States, because it defends the status quo, it defends the establishment. Something is called a political question when it has the audacity to question what the government is doing. And you and TAG have turned to international forums to gain exposure and some relief. So tell us about the United Nations Human Rights Council's Universal Periodic Review, and tell us some of the key elements in the upcoming report that TAG is filing with that body.
We were not completely shocked at the court's decision, but we were also, like Koueda said, you know, not having a lot of faith that we were going to get the justice that we're looking for in our judicial system. The UN, you know, the timing of it couldn't be better, despite the fact that we have an administration that multiple administrations that disregard the UN's authority. The UN is conducting its four-year periodic review of the United States, and that's now. So that's basically, you know, we're submitting our report. And the crux of our report is that we cannot get the justice that we're seeking and in our own system, that we're being forced to be complicit in genocide by paying taxes, that our elected officials, our country, executive and legislative branches are violating our own laws as alleged in our class action. And we're using our class action to launch it, that we tried, CCR tried. We can't keep, you know, butting our heads against a wall. So we're turning internationally and hoping that this will have some other broader impact. And so the report, you know, it details all of the different provisions and, you know, charters and treaties that the behavior of our government is in violation of. But essentially, you know, these are all instruments that have been ratified by the United States and are considered the supreme law of the land under Article 6, Section 2 of our own Constitution. We're supported by a lot of organizations that are signing on with us or endorsing our report, including the National Lawyers Guild International Section, Code Pink. We have International Association of Democratic Lawyers, Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, and more, submitting alongside us, you know, asking for specific relief. So that's something that the UN report allows stakeholders to do. So they can ask for recommendations to be made to the U.S. government, and that's what we're doing. And our recommendations would be pretty obvious: stop funding genocide and war crimes in violation of our own laws and international law. Stop prosecuting, persecuting, deporting, and threatening advocates for Palestinian self-determination and protesters against genocide. Institute effective judicial safeguards against U.S. funding and support of genocide and war crimes. Establish a national human rights institute to train legislators, judges, and federal agency directors in international humanitarian and human rights law and the supremacy of all U.S. ratified human rights treaties under the Constitution. You know, since we started in this process, so much has happened and so much is happening every day. We're constantly having to pivot. For example, we're asking them to honor the principles of academic freedom, stop pressuring universities to police the protected speech of faculties and students, and do not threaten to cut funding in pursuit of a political agenda. We have these really powerful class representative statements that were part of our lawsuit. You know, there's only a 10-page limit on this UN report. There's only so much you can say in 10 pages with what we are trying to address and confront. But just to make sure that those statements aren't lost, we're attaching them in an annex to the report. Whether that's considered, you know, we can't guarantee that it will be, but, you know, we have firsthand accounts of people who have lost over 200 loved ones in this genocide, in, you know, since October 7th.
Now, on April 30th, TAG will file an official complaint with the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. Koueda, what are the essential allegations in this complaint?
Our petition to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights will allege that the United States government, because this is filed specifically against the government as a whole, is complicit in genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity in Gaza by doing a number of different things. First of all, it continues to provide military and financial aid to Israel, despite well-documented evidence of mass civilian casualties, of destruction of essential infrastructure, and targeted attacks on schools and medical facilities, homes, the targeting of civilians. Just last week, we saw the execution of 15 medical workers, and we can continue to see these blatant violations of international law, and yet the United States continues to provide the military and financial aid for Israel to continue this. The United States is also ignoring its obligations under the Genocide Convention, and it's ignoring binding rulings from the International Court of Justice. So the Genocide Convention says it's the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. So the goal is to try to prevent genocide, not only punish it, which means that when countries have evidence that genocide is being committed, they need to do everything they can to try to stop that genocide. In January 2024, the International Court of Justice found that Israel is plausibly engaged in genocide in Gaza. That put the United States on notice that it needs to stop providing Israel with any kind of weapons and do whatever else it can, use its power to stop Israel from what it's doing. And instead of doing that, the United States has continued to ship weapons to Israel and provide cover at the UN Security Council, vetoing resolutions for a ceasefire and other effective measures. The International Court of Justice issued emergency provisional measures to protect the Palestinian people against genocide, and Israel has been ignoring those, and the United States has been providing cover for Israel to continue to ignore those. And then at home, the United States is suppressing dissent and enabling the persecution of those advocating for Palestinian rights, both domestically and internationally. It has intimidated, it has put a sanction on the International Criminal Court, and it is arresting and deporting people here that speak up for Palestinian rights, and that, as Margaret mentioned, it is also threatening and defunding our institutions that allow free speech. So the complaint's going to allege that with these actions, the United States is violating the American Declaration on the Rights and Duties of Man, which really provides the jurisdiction for the Inter-American Commission. Particularly, they are violating the right to life, the right to security of a person and their being, and the prohibition against genocide. The United States is bound by the Commission and this international Inter-American human rights framework. Unfortunately, they don't have a record of respecting the Commission's rulings, but that can't stop us. So we will be making all of these allegations and asking for a ruling that calls on the United States, first and foremost, to immediately stop funding Israel, and then a few more also provisions to protect against things like this happening again.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your co-host, Steve Rohde. Our guests are Huwaida Araf and Margaret DiMatteo. I wanted to turn to both of you to examine the impact of the actions that you're taking. Given that the United Nations and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights don't have prosecutorial power over the United States government, how do you think going to these bodies can help stop the genocide? And I'll start with Huwaida.
Yes, that is a great question. And it is true, neither the United Nations, unless it's the Security Council, of course, and the United States uses its veto at the Security Council to prevent any effective measures to stop Israel, but also the Inter-American Commission, they lack enforcement mechanisms. But we are still going to these bodies because we feel that this will add to increasing international pressure. So a ruling or condemnation from these bodies is going to add legitimacy to the calls for U.S. accountability, and it'll build momentum for global sanctions and arms embargoes and diplomatic consequences you know, against Israel, but also against the United States. And we have seen already internationally that countries are boycotting American products and other things that, smell of America, which is not good for the United States, of course, but it is a means of people who feel helpless against, you know, being able to stop a genocide going to hold the perpetrators of this genocide accountable. And what something that people can do is boycott. The other thing is we want to document. So this will provide legal documentation for future prosecutions. If we have, you know, positive rulings from the United Nations, findings that the United States is in violation of its obligations, and also similarly from the Inter-American Commission, these filings are going to help establish official records that could be used in future legal cases. We will continue to try domestic lawsuits, but also in the future, hopefully, future war crimes tribunals. And these will serve as documentation for these future prosecutions, because we are not going, and international lawyers are not going to stop until not only we're able to stop the genocide and immediately hold the perpetrators accountable, but also hold accountable all those who supported, financed, enabled the genocide. And other things that it can do, it can fuel domestic political and legal challenges. It can, we believe, empower movements for boycotts and divestment. It adds to the record of organizations and institutions focusing on protecting human rights that are calling out the United States for its blatant violations of international human rights. Because I am not being kind of hyperbolic or alarmist here, but we really are at a precipice. This is not just about Palestinian rights. Of course, we want to stop the slaughter, but it's more than just about Palestine. It's about what kind of world do we want to live in. Israel's not only destroying Gaza and trying to annihilate the Palestinian people, it is trying to annihilate the whole international legal order. And if that's the kind of world that we are going to accept, where there is no international legal order, it's just the law of the jungle, I think that nobody is safe. And hopefully these actions also will dissuade future U.S. support for war crimes and help the fight really to hold on to an international legal order that protects people and protects people's rights. Because international law has never been perfect. It has, yes, always really served the interests of the powerful, but it was something, and now the United States and Israel are trying to eradicate that something, and we can't let that happen. So essentially what we're doing is trying to leave no stone unturned to save Palestine, save the Palestinians, but also save the future of international human rights and humanitarian law.
Unfortunately, our allotted time is ending. Margaret, how can our listeners support the work of TAG?
Listeners can support us by joining the movement through our website. It's taxpayersagainstgenocide.org. Participating in campaigns, which there are numerous campaigns happening right now, including tomorrow. Staying informed on our social media channels. You know, we have a lot of amazing folks still behind the scenes working to make sure that we're leaving no stone unturned, as Hoida said, you know, promoting awareness of these issues, because the news media is not, you know, thank goodness for you all and for your focus on this subject. Again, would just encourage folks to check out taxpayersagainstgenocide.org for more information.
I want to thank both of you for being on Law and Disorder. This was a very impressive conversation that we just had. But I also want to thank you both for what you're doing every day in this cause. And we wish you both all the best.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for helping to get the truth out. We don't have very many media outlets doing that, unfortunately.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. For archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. A recent expose by investigative journalist Peter Byrne, titled One Ring to Rule Them All, and published by Project Censored, reveals the unsettling extent of Silicon Valley's deepening ties to the military-industrial complex.
Byrne traces the rise of Palantir Technologies, founded with seed money from the CIA, and ominously named after the all-seeing stone in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. Today, Palantir stands as a $200 billion powerhouse, fueling AI-driven military operations worldwide. Byrne's investigation uncovers how Palantir and its sister company, Anduril Industries, have built an AI weapons consortium that appears to skirt antitrust laws, monopolize Pentagon contracts, accelerate the militarization of artificial intelligence, and bypass essential democratic oversight. His reporting lifts a curtain on the hidden architecture of autonomous weapons systems and exposes Silicon Valley's quiet but profound military takeover. At the heart of the story is a troubling shift: AI systems that could soon make life and death decisions without human intervention. Byrne also draws a sobering parallel between today's AI-fueled war economy and the era of the Gilded Age robber barons. But this time, the stakes are even higher. Not only economic inequality, but also the global proliferation of algorithmic warfare. His work raises a critical question. Are we witnessing the construction of a 21st century ring of power capable of dominating both markets and militaries? Peter Byrne is a veteran investigative reporter with decades of experience uncovering the dark intersections of Silicon Valley, Wall Street, and the ever-expanding military-industrial complex. His work, frequently featured by Project Censored and other independent outlets, has consistently exposed the hidden mechanisms behind surveillance, privatization, and unchecked corporate power. Peter, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
You open your article by describing Palantir as birthed from espionage roots and Tolkien mythology. Why is the story of Palantir's origin important for understanding its present-day role?
Well, I think there's a lot of mythology about the origins of the internet and everything that came after, all the way up until so-called artificial intelligence. A lot of people think it came out of the well in Sausalito, these groovy guys sitting on a houseboat, which is still there, by the way, that they were all like kind of libertarians and lefty, and they were going to revolutionize politics by making communication available to everybody, but it didn't exactly turn out that way. There's a concurrent mythology that's arisen about the so-called PayPal mafia, which includes Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, Reid Hoffman, David Cranes, and others who went on to become multi-billionaires. And, you know, as Yasha Levine shows in his 2018 wonderful book called Surveillance Valley, which is about how Google was always embedded in military and intelligence operations from the very, very beginning, the entire Silicon Valley operation has been embedded in military intelligence operations from the very, very beginning. It's a dual-use technology. It has consumer uses, of course, but it's got primarily military uses in terms of the attraction that the DARPA and the Department of Defense and the CIA and the rest of them, the attraction to the PayPal mafia type of operation, which they funded a lot through their CIA investment arm, which is called NQTEL, but that's a diversion. The point is that they did catalyze a lot of the inventions that we're now dealing with and continue to invest in them. The point is that the military uses of the internet were legion, you know, from the beginning. And PayPal mafia, so-called, which is really about 20 people that came out of the kind of first wave of huge consumer love of the new tools that were brainwashing them, and they were giving money to people to do so. That wave coasted on a type of cultural meme, which is summed up by the Tolkien trilogy that Peter Thiel latched onto. I mean, he's named several of his companies after Tolkien memes, and including a company set up by his protege, James David Vance, who started Narya Capital, which is a Tolkien name. The thing about the Tolkien meme is that it predicates a Manichaean sense of good and evil. And I've always been kind of amused. I mean, I grew up liking their Lord of the Rings, but basically it's the point of view of a bunch of middle-class lazy hobbits in England, right? And they're freaked out by the Bolshevik revolution in the East that has all these mindless orcs working for it. And so they hold on to this ring of imperial power to defeat them, right? Nice story, except, you know, really, when you think about it, the people in the East actually weren't the evil people. I mean, from their point of view, it was the hobbits that were the evil people, right? And so this whole kind of like great divide of everything's either good or evil has permeated Western culture, and Tolkien, you know, he captured it pretty well. So it's no surprise that these PayPal mafia militarists launched onto that, because on the one hand, it's a great brainwash meme because everybody thinks that hobbits are good, right? And they defeat evil. But what they're not recognizing is that power corrupts and that hobbits are not necessarily good. Teal certainly recognized it. The guy is on the record as being against democracy and thinking that women shouldn't be able to vote. And he's just a massively influential and an insidious force in our society, you know. He actually identifies with Sauron, the evil Dark Lord. And so Sauron, you know, made use of the Palantir, which is this big, heavy stone that you can see where your enemies are and your friends, I suppose, too, and then go and kill them if you want to. And so he names his espionage firm Palantir, which was a tiny firm based in Palo Alto. He put in $30 million off of his PayPal winnings. The CIA put in $2 million. And the first kind of software that they invented was to sit on top of large databases. Like, for instance, the FBI or the Los Angeles Police Department, all of whom were their clients, or the CIA, the Army, NSA, they collect incredible amounts of data on a daily basis, and it's almost impossible to parse because it's like exabytes just streaming in constantly. And you can have analysts look at it, but they can't keep up with the amount of electrons that are coming in and photons from satellites in the sky. So computers have always been used to kind of winnow through this stuff and pick out what might be a hot point, like an explosion somewhere or somebody saying, you know, let's have a revolution tomorrow and overthrow Lithuania or whatever. But what Palantir software did, and it wasn't like some incredible invention. It was just, you know, pretty good tech based on the Moore's Law, which is that the computing power of chips doubles every 18 months, which it basically has been doing until recently. It utilized that phenomena and some pretty good code writing. And these software programs, Foundry, Gotham, names like that, sit on top of these databases and help make sense out of them. They go through and they basically find similarities and patterns and pull them up into a user interface. One of the more insidious things about it would be, for example, if you want to predict crime in downtown Los Angeles, which is one of the first uses that Palantir had, you would go and input data about how much crime there is in what areas. And obviously in the marginalized areas is, you know, more blue-collar crime, you know, as it were. And so it would make the analysis that, where there's places where there's broken windows and cars are vandalized, we have to have more policing because that's where there's more crime, right? Which, of course, you know, we all know about predictive policing. It doesn't work. It backfires on itself. It's self-affirming. So that was Palantir's first venture, along with doing the same thing on the border, you know, vetting people that were attempting to flee from economic or political violence. And it took like a long time for it to insinuate itself into the military intelligence world because a lot of its stuff didn't work that well either. It began to leverage contracts that it had in the classified realm to get contracts in the unclassified realm, and then also to go out to businesses like Coca-Cola and say, hey, we've got this cool contract, you know, with government agencies. We can't tell you who they are, but why don't you try us? And Coca-Cola and others did. And businesses don't seem to be all that impressed with Palantir. I mean, it did have a kind of market niche in categorization and sorting, you know, through data points, finding, you know, so-called patterns that it didn't create, but that which are programmed, you know, in for it to find. So it eventually made a big coup when I think it was IBM had a contract for a laptop that was being used in Afghanistan and Iraq by special forces that was supposed to give people all awareness, domain, visualization of the enemy around them, but also like 100 miles away and maybe even 1,000 miles away. It was this fantasy they have, this joint awareness domain command and control system. And the laptop that I think it was IBM had didn't work. And so Palantir put in a bid and they lost. And then they contested the bid and it went to court and they won. They overturned it. So they got to do the laptop. My research shows that people weren't very impressed with the laptop because there's too much information coming in. If you're a soldier sitting behind a hill and somebody's attacking you, you don't care what's going on like 40 miles away or in Paris or whatever. You just want to know how many bullets they have and where they're coming from and maybe how to talk Pashtun in case you get captured, you know. So there's a lot of hype always around Palantir, but at the same time, it was really good at getting lobbyists and branching out, and Thiel would finance other companies such as Anduril, which is a different sort of company. It uses the same type of tech that Palantir has, but it's so-called kinetic. In other words, they make drones that kill people. One hand finds targets and the other hand goes out and kills the targets.
Peter, despite years of operating at a loss, Palantir and Anduril have secured billions in military contracts and avoided paying federal taxes. How does this business model work and who ultimately pays the price?
To answer your question succinctly, the business model works because they have endless streams of cash coming in from venture capitalists whose goal is to throw $100 million at the wall and if, you know, at 100 companies, and if one of them sticks and becomes a billion-dollar company, then they win, right? They're gamblers. They're playing roulette. And in the case of, you know, the military-industrial complex, as it were, you can rig it. You can rig the roulette table because a lot of the contracts they get are sole source contracts because they're written just to the specs that can only be delivered by a certain company like Palantir or Anduril. And they use, weirdly, small business set-asides. Anduril apparently is classified for about half of its contracts, I learned, as a small business, which is crazy because it takes in billions of dollars. I actually called contacted the Pentagon press office and asked them, how does Anduril qualify as a small business? Because it doesn't, under the Small Business Administration guidelines, qualify. It has to have an income of under $47 million to be a small business, and it has a $1 billion income. And they said, we can't talk about the finances of our partners. I did notice, though, the day after that, the Pentagon puts out a list of contracts every couple of days, and I had been seeing that there was a lot of companies that are listed as Small Business Administration set-aside approved, which I want to look into one of these days. And Anduril was, like, right up there, and now I'm noticing that there's no more small businesses in there. I have no idea if it had because, you know, somebody in the press finally asked them what was going on. But clearly, you know, there's a taxpayer lawsuit right there. I mean, giveaways for companies that should be not only paying taxes, but shouldn't be getting set-asides for small businesses that were created to give advantages to so-called minority-owned businesses, women-owned businesses, and veterans-owned businesses, and disabled people's owned businesses. In other words, woke people, right, so-called, in the ridiculous parlance that is turned into its opposite. And so their business operations are based on lobbying, insider knowledge, monopolizing markets, and collaborating to reduce competition, all of which is certainly appear to violate the antitrust laws and regulations of the United States of America.
Peter, on that note, you've written that Palantir and Anduril are forming a consortium that resembles early industrial monopolies. What are the legal and political concerns about this emerging AI weapons cartel?
Well, I believe, Heidi, you're a lawyer, I believe, with some understanding of antitrust, if I read your bio correctly. And I think if we look at the classic paper written in 2017 by Lina Khan, who ended up as Biden's head of the Federal Trade Commission, in that classic paper, which was published in the Yale Law Journal, she concentrated on the Amazon paradox and showed how Amazon had, from the very beginning, taken over markets by underpricing all of the possible competitors, ruining the competitors, and then buying up the competitors. And that is basically how it grew. It's the same way that John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil and railroad company octopuses grew back in the late 19th century. It's the same way that Microsoft, which was actually almost broken up in the 1990s by the Department of Justice antitrust, grew as well through taking huge investor monies for a marginal type of technology like, you know, DOS, where it's never that great, still isn't. You know, Bill Gates' father was a patent lawyer, okay? Bill Gates was a crappy programmer. I mean, it was all about marketing. It was all about patents. It was all about keeping competitors out. The attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation told me, I quoted in the story, you know, there was an antitrust lawsuit against Microsoft in the 1990s that didn't succeed in breaking it up, but probably mitigated it. And according to him, if it hadn't happened, that Google and Facebook would have been strangled in the crib, which too bad they weren't, actually. But that would have been, Microsoft was even more powerful. So the suggestion that Lina Khan made, and I think that she tried to implement, because she did start proceedings against Anduril and Palantir and some Meta and Apple and other behemoths. The main point is that you need to take these companies on as they're starting to emerge as monopolies, because by the time they've already become huge monopolies, it's kind of too late, because they control the United States Congress. They're giving money to politicians. They've actually used their patent capabilities to fence off entire areas of possible technologies that other people could get into. So you need to strangle them in the crib. And state attorney generals are allowed to bring these types of lawsuits, as well as the DOJ. It's unclear at the moment what's happening with the Federal Trade Commission and antitrust of the DOJ. People had expected it to be eviscerated under the Musk-Vance, you know, Trump governmental apparatus. I don't call it administration, I call it an apparatus. But I don't think it is being completely eviscerated, because Trump wants to keep it around to use against his enemies, right? If whether they're, you know, Amazon or Google or whoever, he can bring them into line by threatening antitrust. And if you get rid of the antitrust lawyers, you can't do that. So what you've got here is an opportunity for grassroots, state's attorney generals, people that have these types of legal powers, to say, wait a minute, let's look at the type of collaborations that I expose in my article, which are all, as it were, footnoted. If you click on the links, it's not like I made this stuff up. It's all delineated, sometimes in legal filings and often in journalistic reports and scientific papers, that it's pretty clear that Palantir and Anduril are a mini version of the Standard Oil Company. And if you want to wait until you break up the Standard Oil Company, you're going to end up with Exxon and Mobil and Shell and all the rest of them, right? See, it's so big that when you break it up, you still have 10 monopolies instead of just one, right? So if you really want to believe and promote so-called, you know, free market competition, which American politicians claim to support, then you would look at this emergent octopus in not just Palantir and Anduril, but all these VC-funded AI weapons companies that are coming out of Silicon Valley and the Pentagon. And he would say, wait, stop. We need to have some competition here. You're squashing all these other people that so-called mythological ethics of Silicon Valley said, you know, we're going to let everybody come along and make their own way. No, these people are just replicating what Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and Northrop Grumman and the rest of the primes have been doing for years, which is using their huge amounts of billions and billions of dollars they get for making weapons to control the United States government apparatus and to buy up consumers.
In light of what you've just said, beyond the profits and the contracts, how should our listeners understand the human and geopolitical consequences if this AI military complex continues unchecked?
Well, it's bad enough that the military complex has been continuing unchecked for the last 70 years. But let's just take a case example. Let's look at Gaza and what's going on in Gaza. I mean, the wonderful Israeli-Palestinian reporters bravely exposed a few months ago that Palantir and Amazon and Google and others have concocted these surveillance programs called Gospel, Lavender, and the most evil one of all, Where's Daddy?, where they basically sit on top of identification databases that the Israeli Defense Forces and Shin Bet and all the rest of them have been gathering for decades, in which they claim to be able to identify that so-and-so is a Palestinian activist or he's a quote-unquote terrorist or he's a Hamas or whatever, that they can identify these people and where they live. And so Gospel and Lavender were used to do these so-called targeted assassinations during the genocide on Gaza. And what they would do is they say, yeah, so-and-so lives in this building. So then they send a drone and they blow up the whole building, right? And then it turns out the guy didn't even live there. So the thing is that despite the technical efficacy that these things have in certain narrow uses, if you try to use them generally as surveillance and reconnaissance or as making decisions, they're more prone to false positives than human beings are, actually. I mean, they're just a recipe for making errors, and that's been very clearly demonstrated in Gaza. It's been clearly demonstrated in the Ukraine, where because all these drones are so easily jammable, when you send them out, you can't control where they're going to hit. And so they'll just hit wherever they run out of fuel or whatever. And they're actually so desperate to remove them from the electromagnetic spectrum, which is, you know, jammable, that they extrude these little small wires for, you know, tens of miles, like in order to try and keep their communication so they can be controlled. So there's no good news about this at all. I mean, war has always been a horror in American imperialism, and European imperialism has always targeted civilians. It's just complete, utter nonsense to think that they abide by any international laws or the Nuremberg principles or proportionality or all the other claims that they make to limit so-called collateral damage. No, they attack civilian populations and they intend to kill them and exterminate them as much as possible until they have defenestrated the ruling classes in those areas, and they can go in and seize the raw materials like they want to do in the Ukraine and seize the labor power as they want to do in the United Arab Emirates and places like that. And so it's not looking good. The future of warfare is always against human beings. It requires blood. There's not going to be a bunch of robots going out there fighting each other, and then suddenly China goes, oh, you just beat us in the robot game. Okay, you can have all of our titanium, or the America's going to say, oh, yeah, you can have our oil because you beat us and we didn't have to shed any blood. No, it's always going to end up in nuclear war, because these AI weapons are all interlocked into the joint awareness domain system, command and control system, so-called, which is basically running the nuclear command and control system as well. And all the war games, which is going to be the subject of one of my upcoming reports on military AI watch for Project Censored, it's coming out once a month. That one will be out, I think, the 27th of April. All the war games run by think tanks and by the Defense Department show that any battle between the United States and China over Taiwan ends up in a nuclear war.
Peter, the ethical concern of removing humans from the kill chain keeps coming up, yet you report that Pentagon leaders openly admit that without autonomous killing machines, you will lose. How real is the prospect of AI making lethal decisions autonomously.
You know, the ridiculous notion that was promoted by civil society in particular when they objected to the emergence of AI weapons being able to make decisions about who or what to kill was, you have to have a human in the kill chain. But, you know, legally and morally, that's ridiculous. Where is the human in the kill chain? Is it when the chip is designed? Is it when it's manufactured? You know, I mean, is it when somebody authorizes the drone to go fly over the Ukraine? The Department of Defense has a so-called Directive 3.0009, which says that you have to have some kind of meaningful human control. But then people go back and forth about what's meaningful human control, and it's just a complete circular philosophical cesspit. So the point is, they're paying lip service. The companies that make these things, and even some of the so-called critics of these companies in civil society, and some of the nonprofits that are jumping up and down about it, they're paying lip service to the idea that we have to limit collateral damage and that we can't allow a drone to just go and shoot somebody because they're a black person in a white neighborhood. But that's not the way it works. I mean, these weapons are programmed to do exactly that. They're programmed to do and spot anomalies and patterns according to the command systems that are already embedded in them and set them up. So I think it's ridiculous to give any credence whatsoever to the United States saying that it's going to abide by international law or the Geneva Conventions or its own directives about not allowing autonomous weapons to kill people without having direct authorization from a human being. We've already seen it happen with Sakhar drones in the Ukraine. And we see that the machinery is there. When you read Jane's Defense Weekly, which I do, the weapons are advertised as, yes, they have humans in control, but they also have the option in it not to have the humans in control. And so that's where we're going. And it's not just the weapons themselves. It's going to be the entire command system, because their wet dream is that they can fight world wars in nanoseconds from using computers that are based in, you know, databases owned by like Amazon Web Services, and that they can win. But as I explained in my article, that's a pipe dream, because every single one of the services has their own version of that, and they're all stovepiped and don't connect. So it's just what you call a big S show.
This has been an amazing interview, and we look forward to sharing how our listeners can read the remaining investigation. Should they go to the Project Censored website?
Yeah, sure. Go to Project Censored. We're putting them up once a month. It's the last Thursday of every month. The next one's going to be on the Stargate fiasco, the data centers, and interesting stuff about that I've uncovered. There's a whole range of stuff that's coming up over the next 10 months. And you can also go to my website, which is peterbyrne.info, if you want to look at some of the other stuff that I've been reporting on. I reported recently on how the United States used sarin gas during the Vietnam War. There's many, many other articles there which you might want to take a look at as well, on science and warfare and politics.
All subjects that our listeners are interested in. Thank you so much, Peter, for your important investigation and for being on Law and Disorder.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.